Welcome to Worlds Apart. Over the decades, many words have been written about the nature of the Russia-Turkey relationship, but perhaps one word would be enough to describe it: paradoxical. On the one hand, Turkey supplies weapons to Ukraine, but on the other hand, its trade, including war-inspired trade with Russia, is booming. Turkey is a NATO member, but it also purchased Russian-made air defense systems. What's behind this geopolitical versatility? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Ankara by Tudor Onea, assistant professor at the Department of International Relations at Bill Kent University. Professor Onea, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Now, over the last couple of weeks, we've heard a number of Western officials warn that the course of the Ukrainian war may be changed dramatically, if not decided altogether, within the coming weeks and months. Which way do you think it's leaning?
I don't necessarily think that there's a huge change, because, you know, since this war has started, we are in the wait and see. And we are waiting to see what developments happen on the battlefield. Now, the way I see it, this can play a number of ways. Perhaps, you know, the one that, you know, corresponds mostly to wishful thinking on both sides is a straight victory, and the other side simply decides to concede. It had enough and, you know, it throws in the towel. But a far more likely possibility is for a hurtful stalemate to develop between the two sides. So you do not have a clear winner or a clear loser. And you reach the point where, you know, the countries decide that they have enough and they would like to sit for negotiations. And probably this is the most likely scenario. But there is also the possibility, and this is probably the most worrisome, that one of the two sides, because both sides at the moment are preparing, from what we understand, offensives, and say that one of these two sides gains the upper hand, and then the other decides to escalate. Either by using more lethal weapons or enlarging the conflict through the intervention of third parties. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that, because we are recording this conversation on Wednesday, and this day began with the news from the Russian Minister of Defense about one of its warships in the Atlantic successfully testing a hypersonic missile with a 1,000-kilometer range. And we've also heard over the last couple of days some news from Germany about NATO countries expanding their list of armaments and weapons that they want to send to Ukraine. They're becoming ever more sophisticated. What do you make of all that showmanship? Do you think there is a chance of those weapons being used? And by that, I mean specifically the Russian hypersonic missiles.
As far as I understand, weapons of this, I mean, if you're talking tanks, these have been used since the start of the war. It's just, you know, that Ukraine hasn't really used Western-made tanks, right? And as far as hypersonic missiles are concerned, if the payload is conventional, these are not necessarily different from other types of missiles, right? It will not necessarily be a huge escalation. What I mean in terms of escalation is weapons that are more lethal, right? In terms of a payload, particularly the worrisome factor here is the possibility of use of unconventional weapons. Mm-hmm.
But, speaking about unconventional weapons, I mean, hypersonic missiles is as unconventional as it gets. And I agree with you that there is no point, military point or strategic point, for Russia to use it against Ukraine. But to use it against some of the countries that supply Ukraine with weapons and advisors that then attack Russian military personnel, that makes a perfect sense. I mean, this is war after all. Do you think Moscow was trying to send any signal to the West? And if so, how do you think that signal will be read?
Well, Russia has tried to deter intervention by NATO since the start of the conflict. And I should also say that this has largely been successful. What it hasn't really tried to do is to say, okay, you cannot really send weapons to Ukraine or we are going to attack you. And this would be a very, I should put it, a very dangerous escalation on the part of Russia. It's the, exactly the same sort of argument that Germany used in World War One, right? So the United States was at the time supplying weapons for the Entente, and Germany launched unrestricted submarine warfare in order to stop the supplies. So this I think would be probably a step too far, because so far you can really argue that this is still a war between two sides.
Well, depending on how you define those sides, because for the Russians, it's definitely not the war between Russia and Ukraine. The Russians see it as a war against NATO, and they definitely see that as an existential issue. And by the way, the West also doesn't really hide its intentions to solve the quote-unquote Russian question and to fight until the very end, whatever it means. So if the war is really of such proportion, if it's existential in nature and involves the survival of Russia as a state, do you think that would be such a illogical move for Russia to at least hint at using those weapons against those who sponsor this conflict?
No, when we are saying existential, does it mean that if Russia loses the war, Russia ceases to exist? And the simple answer here is no. No, Russia will continue to exist. Even if it, you know, I mean, losing the war would equivalent to Russia essentially losing the territory it now controls in Ukraine and also the Crimea. But can Russia exist without it? Of course. I mean, look, pre-2014, Russia would still be there. Now, what would be affected, however, would be Russia's status as a great power of the first rank. And it is for this objective that I believe the war is taking place. Mm-hmm. This would, I mean, by the way, this is a very important objective. It is indeed, you know, and throughout history, this has been so for great powers. Great powers are not dying in their sleep of sick of old age. They are usually defeated on the battlefield. So the question is, it has the time come for Russia.
Now, you mentioned the issue of great powers, and you wrote a great book on the grand strategies of great power. I wonder if the definition of what it means to be a great power in this day and age has in any way changed, let's say, from the 20th century.
I don't think so. I mean, it's still based on three criteria. And essentially, a state has to fulfill all three of the criteria in order to be a great power and stay a great power. And these criteria are simply power, behavior, and recognition. So essentially, in order to be a great power, you have to have large resources and varied resources. So in terms of population, in terms of wealth, in terms of military force, and in terms of technology, at the very least. Also, you have to behave like a great power, which means you have to have larger and farther away interests than, you know, your immediate neighborhood. So great power is usually involved in several regions at the same time or in the entire international system, as is the case of the US. And you have to take part in the international management of the system. And finally, to be a great power, you have to be treated as an equal member of the club by the other great powers. This is probably, you know, what is at stake here, because it's pretty much whether Russia is treated as an equal by the United States or not.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think your definition of great powers is pretty much concurrent with how it's described within the Russian political circles. It's primarily for the Russians about their ability to project various forms of power beyond your border, cultural, social, financial, and military. And obviously, Russian power is constrained in some of those realms. But when it comes to, for example, security and military domain, Russia has been increasingly present in some of the Middle Eastern countries. In Africa, it's a number one provider of weapons to Africa and also a provider of military services to a number of African countries, much to the chagrin of the United States. I wonder if you see any connection between Russia's emerging confidence in those affairs and the Western decision to start weaponizing Ukraine very fast, which came, well, at least this is something that the Russians cited as a reason for their military campaign in Ukraine.
As far as I see, this is ultimately not so much a conflict over security. Obviously, I mean, the argument is being made. Ultimately, you know, invoking security is the only legitimate reason to go to war. Either you're under attack or, you know, your ally is under attack, and this is why you're taking security measures. But in fact, everyone is saying this. And if you're looking at, you know, at what Ukraine and what Russia are saying, they are both making this argument, right? I would say, however, particularly because, you know, great powers are involved, this is far more a conflict over power and status involving the United States and Russia. It's a question about Russia asserting a sphere of influence in the former Soviet space, what it calls the near abroad, and Ukraine is essential in order to obtain this. The United States doesn't want to allow this to happen. And this is, you know, at the bottom of what is going on. Of course, there is supply and demand, right? So there is an interest on the part of the United States to supply Ukraine with these weapons, but there is also a nationalist ideology and identity in Ukraine that wants to assert itself and requires asked for these weapons.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your analysis, you called Vladimir Putin a risk-averse loss minimizer. And as much as I actually agree with this characterization, the seemingly most logical way of minimizing the risks for Russia would be just to sit still, try to reach some backdoor agreements with the Americans to avoid public humiliation, but to deal with its resentment and its criticism of NATO encroachment in some other rather than military way. Why do you think the Kremlin took the decision? It took, which, whatever you think about it, could not have been an easy one, not only because of its international repercussions, but also because of the domestic sensibilities. Most of us have relatives in Ukraine.
Well, this is a story, you know, this is a point that, you know, future historians are going to salivate over. So this is definitely going, you know, to lead to a 1,000 books, right? Why did Russia start the war in Ukraine? But as far as I'm concerned, I believe, and you know, this plays into what we have said before, Putin as a risk-averse loss minimizer, as probably the last chance Russia had of not losing Ukraine to the West. Ukraine was arming day by day. It was becoming stronger. And in fact, we see that, you know, the results on the battlefield. If this had been pulled circa 2014, you know, that would have led to a different outcome. It wasn't, right? And so the idea here was, if Russia continue to allow this process to go on, then Ukraine would have become invincible. Ukraine would have gravitated completely into the Western orbit, and Russia simply could not allow this to happen. So it was really the last clear chance to avoid this. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a very interesting point that we have to return to after a short break. Stay tuned.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Food and medicines and supplies and freedom, 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 freedom.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Putin is on offense. Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Tudor Anea, Assistant Professor at the Department of International Relations at Bill Kent University. Professor Anea, just before the break, you mentioned, and you also made that point in some of your articles, that the reason why Russia intervened in Ukraine is because it wants to have its sphere of influence there. I wonder if it's really the case, because if we are, knowledgeable and honest about the political analysis of Ukraine, it's been under Western political domination for many years prior to the start of Russian military campaign. Wasn't it more about not allowing the West to turn its project in Ukraine from a political one into a military one, in which case it would not be about Ukraine? It would be about the West and NATO and its military infrastructure moving ever closer to the Russian capital.
Yeah, but the question here is, why would you necessarily want to move closer? Nowadays, you have the technology to annihilate a state from thousands of kilometers away. This is not, the times of, Napoleon. It's not the times of Hitler, where you have to send in the infantry and the tanks. Russia has the means to deter an attack against itself. It has the means to defend itself. NATO is not crazy. So this is not so much a question of we are going to attack you as a question of we want to actually expand our influence in Ukraine. And so the question here is where Ukraine was going to go. Was it going to go into the European Union? Was it going to go into the Eurasian Union? Economic project that, is supposed to rival the EU, is it going to go into NATO? Is it going to go into the collective security treaty organization? So this is the problem here. And of course, since there wasn't really an agreement between this organization, one potential idea that was bandied about at the time was a potential neutralization of Ukraine, make Ukraine Finland or Belgium. But this didn't come about, and the result was ultimately this conflict.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are one of the few international political analysts who actually read Vladimir Putin's speeches or his articles on the issue, and he's been pretty clear, I think, in most of his writing that he didn't want Ukraine to be part of Russia. He insisted that Ukraine needed to remain an independent state, and from a Russian perspective, it was a good idea because it actually allowed Russia a vested interest in Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. It would create a buffer zone between it and the West, and perhaps that was the best security guarantee for Ukraine. Now that this is a thing of the past and some parts of Ukraine are already incorporated into Russia, what do you think that division line, that boundary is going to be?
This is really the problem, and this is going to be the devil in the final negotiations, right? So the devil is always in the details, right? So who gets what? Ultimately, it depends on what is going to happen militarily. But I would say, despite the many declarations of both Ukrainians and Russian leaders, it's still ultimately on the table for negotiations. Nothing is really settled yet. Mm-hmm. It will pretty much be decided by whoever ends up in a better position at the end of these hostilities.
For any mediation or authentic negotiation to proceed, all sides, including covert actors or behind the scene actors, they all need to make the calculation that continuing hostilities are more detrimental to their interests than peace. I think I can figure out what would be Russian and Ukrainian constraints because they're fighting on the battlefield, they're losing people, they're losing resources. But what about the Americans and the European allies, they don't seem to be losing as much. What could possibly inspire them to be more in favor of peace?
Right now, both sides, and you know, here we are talking here about Ukraine, plus say the well-wishers of Ukraine, which is NATO, EU, American allies in Asia, etc. And on the other side, you have Russia. And so the problem here is that both sides still believe that victory is possible. As long as they will entertain this belief and they are willing, you know, to spend resources in order to get to that point, hostilities will go on. What is needed in order for peace to happen is for these sides to give up on the prospect of victory. So victory is simply too expensive, it is out of reach, and therefore, if this goes, if this is set aside, then the only solution is to settle. And simply, we are not at that point yet. That's, you know, and this also shows the magnitude of the stakes involved, because it seems that, you know, all the resources that have been sacrificed so far have not been enough.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned that all sides are still going for victory, but the Russians have never actually defined clearly their military objectives. So it's very difficult to say what they would regard as victory. From Moscow's perspective, it's already achieved quite a number of goals, and it sought to sort of put them in stone with the acquisition of those regions. Do you think the status quo as of now would be satisfactory for all sides, given that it's very unlikely that Moscow will backtrack on any of the recent moves?
Probably not. Now, for Ukraine has set up, you know, maximalist goals. So every inch of territory plus Crimea needs to be, the way they put it, was liberated. And as far as Russia is concerned, we know that, you know, the minimal demand there is for the Donbas. Then you have all these new territories that, you know, have been added to the Donbas. But the thing is, even if this was conceded today to Russia, this wouldn't really satisfy Russia's political objectives, which are to, you know, force Ukraine into essentially its orbit. And this is not likely to happen. The only way, you know, this would, you know, the war would end in a way that would satisfy Russia would be either with Ukraine simply capitulating, and this was probably the objective at, you know, the beginning of the hostilities, you know, complete occupation, a pro-Russian government in Kiev, a government that gives up on the Donbas, a government that gives up on joining NATO, a government that pretty much joins the Russian project. Or failing this, a Ukraine that is so dramatically weakened from the conflict that it wouldn't put much challenge in the future. So for instance, an ability to cut Ukraine away from, you know, the Black Sea through, say, occupying Odessa. And that would be a Ukraine that would be dramatically weaker economically, politically, and it would be a question of Russia then finishing the job at some later point.
I have a problem with this kind of analysis, which I hear a lot in Western media, primarily because I think, as you said, Putin is a risk-averse loss minimizer, and he's a pretty shrewd man, understanding that the anti-Russian sentiment in Ukraine is extremely strong. There have never been much appetite in Moscow for, you know, Western Ukraine, you know, Galicia and other lands like that. So why would Russia ever want to get itself involved into those lands when it faced, even under Joseph Stalin, under the Soviet rule, there was many separatist and insurgent issues there? So don't you think that Moscow would much rather be satisfied with the West taking the rest of Ukraine under its own wing and, you know, paying for the reconstruction and taking care of the people?
Well, a possible division of the state is also on the table. This is also a possibility. So you might have a sort of, like you had the Federal Republic of Germany and then you had the Democratic Germany, you might end up with West Ukraine and East Ukraine. In fact, it would be more like Northwest versus Southeast. to tell you the truth. But one point I think should be made fairly clear. This is not about Russia recreating the Soviet Union. It's impossible to completely conquer another state. As you say, this would be, you know, prohibitively expensive. And I don't think that Russia is interested in this. But what it really wants is for a government that pays attention to its security interests and to its, you know, to its status, to its power, right? So ultimately, what it wants is some form of a client government in Kiev. This is, by the way, I mean, it's not unheard of. It's essentially what the sphere of influence is about. You're not necessarily controlling the domestic politics of the state as much as you control its foreign policy. Mm-hmm. So this, I believe, is what Russia is after.
Now, Professor Ener, I have to ask you about Turkey, because this is something I announced in my introduction, and we barely spoke about Ankara. And yet, so far, it has been by far, I think, the only international player that has made any inroads in terms of bringing the two sides together. There was a meeting between the foreign ministers of Russia and Ukraine in Turkey last year, which even reached some agreement, which nonetheless was later upended by the Ukrainian side. Do you think it is still worthwhile for Turkey to try to negotiate this dispute, or it's still too early for that?
It's definitely worth it. Ultimately, it elevates Turkey's position, right? It first of all, it makes Turkey appear as the kingmaker, right, and in this conflict, and also if it, you know, manages to deliver a diplomatic settlement, well, it is success, and success gives you points, right, in international relations. The problem here, and as far as I can see, and here you're absolutely right, you need to involve more sides, and the one side that you really need in particular to be involved is the United States, right? You cannot just have Ukraine and Russia talking to each other, but at the same time, you don't have dialogue between the great powers. And in this capacity, I don't know if Turkey really can deliver, because at the moment, Turkey and American relations are fairly tense.
And that's also something that Russia relies on, because it's been very active in trying to rely on Turkey to ease the pressure of Western sanctions. There are many war-inspired enterprises, including the proposal to build a gas hub in Turkey. Do you think it's sensible for Russia to rely on Turkey, given even not only the long history, very volatile history between our two countries, history that was, you know, full with various betrayals, but also recent history over Syria, many disagreements there. Why do you think Russia is entrusting itself to Turkey at this very sensitive point of time?
If you're Russia, you're actually looking for friends wherever you can find them. And you cannot really be picky or choosy. But in effect, if you're looking at the history of the relations, this goes further back. And so there was an increasing rapprochement between Russia and Turkey since the coup, right? And since the government of Russia actually came up very much in support of the government in Ankara. And I would say, of course, there are differences, but there are also overlapping interests, and some of them do concern Syria. In fact, it is, as you know, I have mentioned in a former interview, quite possible that we are looking at you know, the possibility of a Syrian endgame, which actually would bring together not only, you know, the presidents of Russia and Turkey, but maybe we might have a rehabilitation of the government in Damascus. So we might see in the future a meeting between President Putin, President Erdogan, and President Assad.
Well, Professor Ener, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.